Good evening. This is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It is program number 775, October the 13th, 1986. The events that we are all reading in the newspaper are passing so quickly it is hard to understand one article and delve into it at length before another event comes, and they're going by like flashcards. It's hard to say sit still time and let's see what this is all about. Now, what I'm going to do for the next 2 weeks is to just talk about Nicholas Daniloff and what preceded the summit meeting and the situations behind his background to get a full perspective. It's not a full because I don't have all the pieces, but I can ask some good questions once in a while. But I'm going to stop relating to other events so that I can get as much as possible into two radio broadcasts consecutively. Last week, I was just mentioning the running of time, how the hijacking in Pakistan has been covered up, the synagogue machine gun firing in Turkey, the French bombings. All that has been to a standstill for the past week and a half. After Mr. Daniloff was out and traded for the KGB spy, the summit came and went, and there are a lot of things I'd like to say about that. The news about Libya and the disinformation continued, the president lying and National Security Advisor Admiral Poindexter lying to the American people about Gaddafi has gotten a lot of flack. The veto on the South African sanctions, the overriding of the president's veto, of course, hasn't been in the news this week. The explosions of the Aryan Nations are off the front pages again, and I want to go back to Dan Rather a little later in this broadcast or next week. And in this past week, since we shared time on the air together, Henry Kissinger made the cover of Newsweek. I mentioned last week that he's doing everything he can to sabotage or to put a wedge into any decisions in the summit that Ronald Reagan just had, particularly that have to do with Star Wars. The American plane was shot down over Nicaragua on the 8th of October, linked immediately to the CIA, and then within 2 days, by the 10th, just when the president is arriving in Iceland for the summit, the headlines have George Bush, the vice president, connected to the Contra plane. That came out very quickly. And then suddenly Bernard Kalb left the State Department because of what he said were lies. Well, that man has been so far up to his neck in lies in the State Department, but he's very, very close to Henry Kissinger, and both of them were giving Ronald Reagan a lot of flack when he went off to meet Mr. Gorbachev. I will go into the Nicaraguan airplane crash happening this time. Several weeks ago, I started and didn't get to update Jonathan Quitney's article in the Wall Street Journal about La Costa and Lorimar Productions and their links to Jimmy Hoffa. A lot of that we haven't even shared on the air together. And that was September the 15th, and I felt that if you just peeled that parchment back a little bit, you'd get Paul Laxalt, a candidate for the next president of the United States. And I believe that the naming of George Bush so quickly in this Nicaraguan plane crash is counteracting the conflict between Paul Laxalt and George Bush for the presidency. We're going to see a White House type of tug and pull, and I'll do more on that later. David Emery called me this evening from KFJC, or yesterday rather, and asked about that power struggle. He saw it the same way, and in a few weeks I'll detail that for you. The earthquake in El Salvador took place on the 11th, Saturday the 11th. I'm very suspicious of the circumstances under that. I've studied a few mysterious earthquakes, possibly linked to the intelligence community, and I'll go into those later, and all of the activities, not all, but a great many of impressions of activities of the summit, the 3 days of October 10, 11, and 12, I'll update with you later. I did want to spend the month of October and the month of November, those 8 weeks, talking about events that are in the news that pertain and go back to the murder of John Kennedy and the Kennedy assassination. And I cited just last week a man named Dan Rather who had a part in some way in the Kennedy assassination. He had been to Jack Ruby's nightclub. He had seen Lee Harvey Oswald there. All of that going back to 1963. And then this mysterious pouncing by two men on Park Avenue that took place last week it was. Now, I believe maybe there's a connection between what Dan Rather knows in the Kennedy assassination and Nicholas Daniloff, and maybe it wasn't a coincidence at all. I don't think it was a coincidence that they ruffled him up, but what are his links to the Kennedy assassination? I'll go into more of that in a few moments. A lot of people perceive the significance of the Kennedy assassination as being a changing point of American history, which it was, in fact. Very few will acknowledge yet that it was a coup d'etat, except the most serious researchers, and even among those, there's a difference of opinion. Some refuse to acknowledge that that's what this event was. And the people who had a role in murdering John Kennedy, or had a role in covering it up, are in the news almost every single day. The corporations like Schlumberger, the H.L. Hunt family, the Merchants and family, John Connolly, Gordon Novell, Arlen Specter, the Warren Commission. So I do want to take the people in the news today who had a role in the killing of Kennedy or the cover-up and update you for the next 8 weeks. I'll have other current events thrown in there too, but the gist of the program is going to be the Kennedy assassination. That's what started me doing my research, November 22, 1963. It'll soon be the 22nd anniversary since the murder of John Kennedy, and I actually could do one program a week just on John Kennedy and never get caught up on these characters. Now, at the time of Watergate, there were hearings Senator Frank Church had in Congress, the 95th Congress, and included among the many, many volumes of these hearings were about 400 pages of one volume called The CIA and the Media. These were hearings before the Subcommittee on Oversight of the Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, House of Representatives. Oh, this was Representative Pike's hearing. Senator Frank Church was doing some of the other hearings, and this was the news media hearings were done by Representative Pike. And they were available at one time at the government printing office, but I don't believe they are now. And one of the first witnesses, of course, before those hearings was William Colby, and he's talking about the CIA and the Central Intelligence Agency. Now, these hearings took place explaining the role of the CIA and spying with the news media. But the hearings taking place in 1975, also, because they got caught at the time of Watergate, also include all those years that Nicholas Daniloff went from London, where he was hired by UPI, the United Press International, in 1958, and has stayed with the news media up to the present time. But from 1958 until 1975, when they got caught and exposed at the time of Watergate, the CIA had over 400 representatives in the news media, and Daniloff was in the milieu of all of those people. Now, William Colby testified. He was former director of the Central Intelligence Agency, and he said to Representative Pike, "Mr. Chairman, I want to clarify some relationships between the CIA and the press and identify the appropriate guidelines for the future," because they got this slap on the wrist. He said, it is essential to recognize the important CIA responsibility to collect what is known as overt information. This includes non-controversial activities as subscribing to journals, news services, gathering technical publications, encyclopedias, recordings, analyzing public radio broadcasts and statements of other nations in the world. It includes CIA offices in 40 cities of the United States where they work, and they request fellow citizens to share with their government information they may have about foreign matters. And, of course, this included American matters, too, illegally in the United States. He said, in this overt operation and information capacity, the CIA is merely a subscriber to the product of the journalists and a recipient of whatever information citizens wish to share with their government. To the extent that newsmen have contact with the CIA in informal exchanges with CIA station chiefs abroad and analysts at home, there's no interference with the independence of our press that takes place. Now, that's an outright lie, of course. Just the CIA saying that Oswald killed John Kennedy is an interference with the press. He said, of course, some relationships in the past have gone beyond these and included CIA employees on specific intelligence missions abroad who served as real or pretended journalists. I've handled such persons in my service. The news reports that they report are a matter between them and their editors. They're not given clearance by the CIA. The reason for the understanding is simple. The function of the CIA is to work abroad, not to determine the content of American media. And, of course, that is a lie also. Lying, as he testifies. Discussions were brought up of the CIA's relationship with the press and cases of the CIA operating covertly to control what appears in the American press. He said the CIA effort to affect public opinion are aimed abroad, conforming to its mission assigned by a series of American presidents and supported by a series of American Congresses. Of course, there's no limit to what they can print abroad. Then it can be picked up from the London Times and the Le Monde and the French newspapers and papers all around the world, and it becomes fact in this country, although it was printed abroad to slant matters. Then William Colby said, obvious means for exerting influence have been foreign journals and other media affecting public opinion and attitudes and actions in those countries. For many years, clear doctrinal differences have governed such work, differentiating between what is white propaganda, acknowledged openly by its source, the U.S. government, in which case it would not be a CIA task. It would be published, and then the CIA would use it. Then he gets into gray propaganda, and this is one of the areas that Nicholas Daniloff was absolutely involved in. CIA uses gray propaganda, unattributed to some ostensible third party. And then there's the black propaganda, which pretends to be the output or even internal document of the target group. While some black propaganda was indeed produced by the CIA and circulated abroad, for the largest part of its effort fell in the gray area, where they printed something and attributed it to one person, and it actually, that person didn't exist. It was a CIA agent. He said this included the support of journalists and other media circulating material beneficial to the United States and such larger operations as Radio Free Europe, which was formed under ostensibly private sponsorship to avoid diplomatic constraints applicable to governmental emanations. Translated, that means we made U.S. Information Agency and the Radio Free Europe, Radio Free America, Radio Free America is Niptuck and David Emery's program up north, but Radio Free Europe is the counterpart, the fascist element, and theirs is the exposing of that group. But William Colby went on to say, and detail, and there are 400 pages of the use of the media of 400 news people in these particular hearings. Now we go to Nicholas Daniloff and his gray area. In the course of articles written about him in the past 3 weeks, I haven't been able to read every word of every article, but the parts that I have read that are important chronologically, I want to share with you to get an overview of Nicholas Daniloff from what they have told us so far, and then if you have a good imagination like me, you might begin to wonder about the missing years. Now, as I'll detail later, his great-grandfather was tried and sent to Siberia because he was part of an assassination plot to kill the Tsar. That's very nice lineage. Then his grandfather was a spy for the Tsar's intelligence system. So he came out of a birth from a team of potential assassins and spies to begin with. Nicholas Daniloff himself was born in Paris in 1934. His family left the Soviet Union with grandpa and great-grandpa in the clink. They got out and went to Paris when the revolution came down. He was taught Russian from his Russian grandmother, who didn't go to Siberia with the other ones. And from the time he was 10 or 12, he learned the Russian language. Now, being born in Paris, he stayed there a certain amount of time. And then there's a time period, a long time period, of from 1935 up until 1952 when he entered Harvard. And the only two places that he identifies living are when he moved to New Hampshire before he went to Harvard. Now, he could have been there 10 years and he could have been there 1 week. We'll have to look that up and maybe you can fill in some of these pieces. But he moved from Paris to Argentina. Now, Argentina is where Rudolf Hess was flying down to set up the Fourth Reich in case the Third Reich failed. It's where Martin Bormann was ready to salt money away for the resurgence of Nazism and Hitler to overthrow the Soviet regime for the third time the Germans would try. Argentina was run by Juan Perón, and it was called Little Germany down there. It was a hotbed of Nazis and the emigre from the Russian Revolution who were working with the Nazi government, hoping that they would be able to be returned to their land if Hitler won the war. So he spent time in Argentina growing up there, and under Juan Perón would be as bad as living in Paris under Adolf Hitler. So we don't know if the family of Danilov, with their interesting background, were part of the milieu of the French Nazis, or were there part of the time and then went to Argentina, where the German, French, and Russian czars were, particularly the German and Russians. But he was in Argentina at that time, then went to New Hampshire, and I don't know if he was all four high school years in New Hampshire or not. Again, the route was Paris to Argentina, New Hampshire. He entered Harvard in 1952. Those are the years that this Dr. Elliott was very active in Soviet affairs. That was the location of the home base of Henry Kissinger, put there by John J. McCloy, particularly with his interest in resurgence in releasing Nazis out of war criminals, and with his friend, his Fritz Gustav, Anton Kramer. But the two of them, Kramer was so influential, as was John McCloy, and Kramer was from Germany, and German intelligence and American intelligence. They put Kissinger into Harvard, and he spent formative years there during this time period. Danilov, of course, is younger, but he went to Harvard from 1952 until 1956, when he graduated. And then he went to Washington, D.C., right from Harvard, where else? And he says he applied for the CIA and the State Department, and I'll go into that in more detail in a little bit, and U.S. Information Agency and Foreign Service. But in 1956, summer of 56, he graduated in June, he took a little trip up to the North Pole for a summer job, and then in the fall of 1956, he began working for the Washington Post, a long conduit of the intelligence community, and again, I'll go into more of that later. In 1957, he went to Britain, and then went to Oxford University, and then was hired for UPI, and went to Geneva, Switzerland. He met his wife, Ruth, in London when he was there, and married her in Switzerland. And then in 1961, he went to Moscow, to the Soviet Union, where he stayed till 1965. And again, I'll go back to these details later, but those were the years of Lee Harvey Oswald and Yuri Nosenko coming to this country, and Marina Oswald coming to this country. In these very informative years, Danilov was in Moscow. In 1965, he returned back to work for the Washington Post. In 1966 to 1973, that's a nice hunk of time, and think of the history that happened through those times. He worked for United Press International in the State Department, the Defense Department, and the White House. And then in 1970, this is when the CIA was using these 400 journalists for this time period. And in 1973, he stopped working for the State Department, Defense Department, and White House as a journalist and went back to Harvard to study Chinese in 1973. Now, I don't know how long he studied Chinese, whether it was 1973 or 74, but there's a time period after at Harvard, say if he was there 2 years, from 1974 to 1980, 6 years that are totally unaccounted for, where heavy espionage training and so forth could be put into effect after he learned his Chinese. But in that interim in 1977, he had joined the team that tried to sabotage the House Select Committee on Assassinations with John Kennedy, and that's why I think he's so terribly important, one of the reasons. He joined U.S. News World Report in 1980, and when Reagan became president in 1981, he was back to Moscow. That's just a thumbnail sketch in chronological order, because some of the background articles that I'm going to cite, some have one piece of information and the others another, but this is a very significant and important person, and when you read the details on him, and I've only scratched the surface, there's so much to read and keep up with all the other news, you begin to get a picture of why Ronald Reagan absolutely panicked when Danilov was arrested and would do anything, including hurrying to get together with Mr. Gorbachev to get Danilov out and home. Danilov, I believe, working in Moscow, could have a very important role in the Kennedy assassination, and I know Ronald Reagan in California, with his mentors, also had a very good role in covering up the Kennedy assassination, so they had something in common. Now, a very good listener to World Watcher, a loyal listener, and a person who provides information, came across something this week that began to turn my head around about Danilov and makes sense because of all the commotion of this particular person since the middle of last month. He was reading a book called Codename Zorro by Mark Lane and Dick Gregory, published by Prentice Hall in 1977. And this book is about Martin Luther King, and it's about King's policies, how the FBI followed Martin Luther King, and how the inclusion of the investigation of Martin Luther King happened to be put together with the investigation of the murder of John Kennedy the second time around. And there are a lot of forces that have been desperate to cover up the White Russian Solidaris, Tolstoy Foundation, Greek Orthodox Church of Lee and Marina Oswald, to 28 people in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, as well as people in the Soviet Union and people in New Orleans and the Dallas-Fort Worth area that were all of this ilk and had one thing in common, which was to return to the Soviet Union and get rid of the Soviet Bolsheviks that were in power, referring to them current articles this week, the Bolsheviks. Chapter 29, The Beginning, is by Mark Lane, and he tells how the Citizens Commission of Inquiry began investigating or getting Congress to include Martin Luther King. And he said in February 75, he founded the Citizens Commission of Inquiry to urge the opening of the assassination of John Kennedy. And later, they pursued the investigation of Martin Luther King. Now, he mentioned some interesting people who were helping him, and many of them were from the CIA intelligence community. I never trusted Mark Lane anyway, and once he got the King case opening, he ran out very quickly because the Jonestown clan were going to be exposed, and Leo Ryan, Representative Leo Ryan, was going down there, and Mark Lane, representing Jim Jones, had to hop a plane and walk out of the committee after he worked 2 years to get them to start investigating the Martin Luther King assassination. He says at the time he was director of this committee to open up the assassination, he was teaching at Columbus School of Law at the Catholic University of America, which is an interesting place for Mark Lane. He tells how he went to Congressman Henry Gonzalez of San Antonio, Texas, who wanted to open up these assassinations and believed that they should include the murder of Robert Kennedy because, as Representative Gonzalez said, these assassinations changed the course of history. They thwarted democratic process. They eliminated options. They baited domestic unrest and caused great harm to the collective national psyche, the extent of which I strongly feel it is Congress's responsibility to assess. So Henry Gonzalez proposed House Resolution 209 in the House of Representatives February 19, 1975, to open up this investigation of John Kennedy, and he did want the two Kennedys and Martin Luther King to be investigated. And then another resolution, House Resolution 498, was proposed by Representative Thomas Downing. Now, Downing was very conservative. He was retiring as a Democrat from Virginia. He took on the responsibility of this political act, which was out of context for his particular behavior or interest previously when he was in Congress. So there were two resolutions. Either one would be appropriate, 204 or 498, and the hope of various researchers was to get the investigations going and see if we could get more information on the murder of John Kennedy and Reverend Martin Luther King. As I say, the Robert Kennedy was dropped like a hot potato for very good reasons because of its connections to California and Richard Nixon and Ronald Reagan that are even much closer than Reagan's connections to Kennedy's assassination, although those are very, very close. So Mark Lane describes the resolution that was passed by a vote of 280 to 65, and Richard A. Sprague from Philadelphia was supposed to be the chief prosecutor. And there was a lot of action, people wanting to get these stories open, to find the links, particularly the Martin Luther King story just reeked of a conspiracy. The other one, John Kennedy's assassination, was equal in scandals of conspiracy. So these resolutions were about to be considered by the Rules Committee, and they were favorable, but there was a lot of flack in the news media, and this is where Mr. Daniloff comes in. And Mark Lane tells about in 1977, the Rules Committee reported a compromise resolution on these suggestions to open up. They placed the Select Committee on probation for 2 months to get a modest budget, and then they would bring it up again in April of 1977, and the Congress would decide to reestablish the committee or perhaps forever end any hope of such an inquiry. So in February of 1977, Mark Lane went to Boston University, and he called Dick Gregory, and he said that he would like to have some kind of a hearing or vigilance in front of the house where John Kennedy was born, and that they would stand in silent vigil until the dawn, hoping that these two deaths, John Kennedy and Martin Luther King, would be opened up, and they would represent these two particular interests. So 200 people, students, professors, and others, walked with them for an hour in the frigid winter night from Boston University to John Kennedy's birthplace. It was 19 degrees below freezing. Various reporters dropped in through the night, and one person delivered a message from Steve Krause of the Boston office of the United Press International. Now, that's the agency that is going to send Mr. Daniloff, or had sent him to Moscow, rather, in 1961, the UPI. And the message was that they wanted him to call him. Mark Lane called him. He said, "I did so. And I told him that we were having a silent, prayerful vigil, and he seemed receptive and supportive." So the UPI had sent a message to Mark Lane, and he said, "We're having this vigil of 200 people, a silent, prayerful vigil." Now, the next afternoon, he said, "I arrived in Washington in time to witness a debate about the resolution to open up these assassination investigations. The closing remarks were made by Representative Robert Bauman of Maryland." And Robert Bauman is the gentleman who just finished writing a book about his being gay in Washington and his habit of going every night to the gay bars and literally being forced to resign out of the Congress because of being gay. And he said there's still people in the White House who are, and he's been very angry. This book that he just came out with is very angry. But it's interesting that in Congress, on the floor of Congress, after the UPI contacted Mark Lane, they selected Robert Bauman of Maryland. And this is what he said on the floor of Congress the day that they wanted to open up these hearings. He said that the Washington Post, and that also is the newspaper, the Washington Post and the UPI, exchanged Mr. Nicholas Daniloff back and forth frequently. The Washington Post called the Select Committee perhaps the worst example of congressional inquiry run amok. Bauman then made a charge that caused considerable concern on the floor of Congress. He said, "I'm aware of that this matter arouses certain passions, opening up the Kennedy and the King assassinations. Last night, the Speaker of the House was subjected to a public demonstration in Massachusetts, warning him, in quotes, 'They are watching Tip O'Neill. What do you do in this matter?'" End quote. A statement from Mark Lane, who had been a champion of the investigation. They quoted Mark Lane as threatening, "Tip O'Neill, we are watching you. What are you going to do? Are you going to open this up?" He said, "When I inquired that day, I discovered that Representative Bauman based his allegation against me on a UPI story. During the vigil, I had not mentioned Tip O'Neill. I had not led a demonstration against him or stated or implied we were watching him. I secured a copy of the UPI that had misled Bauman, and it carried a Nicholas Daniloff byline and read, 'The night before the House debate, comedian and activist Dick Gregory and author Mark Lane led a group of 200 people in a vigil outside of John Kennedy's birthplace. This vigil is to let Tip O'Neill, we're watching him,' end quote," said Richard Feldman, a spokesman for the group. On February the 4th, Mark Lane wrote to Congressman Bauman and wanted to know about the facts. On February the 7th, he asked for and received unanimous consent from the House of Representatives to correct the record. On that occasion, he admitted his error. This is Mr. Bauman, and apologized for an inconvenience to me. "I wonder who Richard Feldman was. Clearly, he was not a spokesman for our group. This was no formal group. I called Nicholas Daniloff and said, 'Who is Feldman?' And he said, 'Feldman, you've got me.' and I told him the UPI story that carried his name, read that Mr. Feldman was at these meetings. He said, I'll be damned. I did write the story. I never quoted Feldman. Who is he? I never put those words in there. I asked him, who did quote Feldman? He said, the only person who could have changed my story, I can't imagine she would, is the overnight editor, Elizabeth Wharton. I called her and apprised her of the fact that Feldman quote was not in there in Daniloff's story. He's right. He didn't put it there, neither did I. And that's the gray disinformation that the House Select Committee people would threaten the Speaker of the House, and there is no Feldman, and involved Nicholas Daniloff and UPI. And Mark Lane went on and said, this is very strange, and Mr. Daniloff apologized. He says, it's something that could not have happened, but it did. It was a phantom quote from a mystery person, emerged in a UPI story from the Washington Bureau in a fashion that remains an enigma to the Washington Bureau of the UPI. It found its way into the floor of Congress to be used as a weapon against the investigation of the assassination of John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. I'll take a 1-minute break and continue on Nicholas Daniloff